from WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ever feel like you're racing too fast through life, trying to keep up not just with work and family, but with your coworkers, your neighbors, your friend's friend who has a house with an indoor basketball court? And in that race to get ahead, you're nowhere close to the big leagues. Your long hours haven't translated into the mega house or the great car. Instead, they've meant big sacrifices. You're burned out. You miss your family. You're treading water. In his new book, Is the American Dream Killing You?, our guest, Paul Stiles, says it's time to step back, to appreciate life beyond getting ahead, and to recognize the enormous cost of the market in our lives. This hour, On Point, the rough side of the American dream. You can join the conversation. Are you living the American dream, or are you sacrificing family, sleep, health, just to stay in the game? Do you wish you were living another life but feel trapped? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from the Canary Islands, Spain, is Paul Stiles, author of the book Riding the Bull, My Year in the Madness at Merrill Lynch. His new book is The American Dream Killing You? How the Market Rules Our Lives. He's a former intelligence officer at the National Security Agency, the NSA, bond trader on Wall Street, and CEO of the internet startup company for travelers, iJet. He now lives in the Canary Islands, where he's interviewing expatriates who celebrate a slower pace of life for a new book. His website is www.paulstiles.org. Paul Stiles, hi, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, good to be here.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Bob. Hello to our guest, and I'm here in prosaic Hanover, New Hampshire.
First, Paul Stiles, frame this conversation for us, would you? What do you mean when you use the term the market?
Yeah, the market is not a trading floor in New York, and it is not just, as economists would tell us, a kind of level playing field where buyers and sellers meet. The market is a profound force in our lives. It has all kinds of different facets: market principles, market forces, market culture, market values. It's a real octopus with a lot of different arms, so I just call it the market with a capital M. And it's this force that we're feeling all the time, whether it's competitive pressures or survival pressures or social pressures or financial pressures. It's really this market beast that's ratcheting down these pressures on our heads to try to make us more productive. And to a certain extent, we need that. But my point in this book is it has gone way overboard.
Why do you call it a beast?
You know, the interesting thing is that if you look at the symbols of the market in history, they are all animals. And it's really a beast because it's me versus you. It's the essential principle of competition. And when you strip that away from any higher values, what you get is a very Darwinian, natural environment.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to reference those images, you know, the bull and the bear in the stock market, or from the movie Wall Street, say, Gordon Gekko. He's named after a reptile. Or even in the Industrial Revolution, you know, the idea that when you take it to real excess, you breed a kind of capitalist pig. These are all images drawn from nature, and they reveal, I think, what subconsciously we think of life in a pure market-driven environment.
You mentioned the rules of the market. Is the key rule, in a sense, an extension of the laws of nature, survival of the fittest?
Yes.
Explain that.
Yes, it is. Well, there's essentially two things going on, I think, in our society. And one is this idea of me versus you, which is the idea of competition. And the other is the idea that prevents us from destroying one another with that, which is the idea of us. And us can be at multiple levels. You know, it's the family, it's our community, it's our corporation, the nation. But what has happened is that the force of me versus you in our society, for various reasons, has become so strong that is eroding the various levels of us. So you have, for instance, in the community, people bowling alone, as Robert Putnam put it, or you have family breakdown, or you have at the national level the abandonment of public service by the upper class, or in the corporation you have the dissolution of corporate loyalty. All of these are the levels of us that have been eroded by this intense me versus you force that the free market has unleashed on American society.
In the book, you argue it goes beyond policy, though. You say it's having real physical effects on us as well.
Tremendous physical effects. You know, over half of all people, and this is actually a conservative estimate, over half of all Americans who go to see their primary care physician are going there for stress-related reasons. That's an astonishing fact.
But is this what the average American experiences? And if the average American is facing these problems, do they attribute it? Does he or she attribute it to, quote-unquote, the market?
They don't, because we haven't really drawn the line, if you will, all the way back from these surface symptoms down into the depths of where the market force is really lurking, you know. When something happens, like a corporate scandal, we focus on what so-and-so did in that company. We're not really focused on the fact that the person that has just bankrupted his corporation has, in effect, been responding to pressures put on him throughout his entire life in his corporation. And these pressures are so intense that he's lost his morality.
How
we don't do that.
How has market-oriented success been taken to the extreme?
Market-oriented success? You mean financial success?
Correct.
Well, it's become the arbiter of all value. Look at American heroes. Are they real heroes? Are they people who've actually, you know, made some great medical breakthrough? Or are they simply people who have made a lot of money and we aren't really that interested in how they got there? But just by virtue of the fact that they're rich, they are considered successes. And, you know, I think the poster boy for this is Bill Gates. I mean, we've all seen on television that the movie, I think, about Bill Gates walking off with the Windows operating system from Apple. But do we ever ask that those are ill-gotten gains then? A lot of the man's wealth must have come at someone else's expense. These are the types of things I think we just assume that as long as someone's rich, it's okay.
But Bill Gates on the other side, I don't want to be a Bill Gates defender here, but Bill Gates on the other side has done a lot of good in the world. Look at his foundation that's funding quite a lot of medical work in third world countries, particularly in Africa, where he spent millions and millions and millions of dollars, tens of millions, fighting malaria.
Yeah, I know. People make this point, and I think, you know, it's certainly valid, and he is definitely to be commended for that. And I don't want to get too far off track, but I don't think that we can look at someone like Bill Gates and say that the computer revolution, say, would not have occurred without him. There's a tremendous amount of creativity that would have been unleashed if it had not been harnessed or controlled by one corporation.
Jack Beatty, step back and let's get your take on this.
Well, you know, this fear about the market, about getting and spending and its threat to our larger life, this goes way back in American history. It was there with the founders. They put great store on two things. They wanted to preserve a republic. And the essence of that to them was that the idea that the individual would sacrifice his individual interest to the greater good of the whole. That was their notion of what republicanism was. And in a despotism, not much was expected of the citizen. In a republic, much was. The citizen had to be able to do that, to put his individual interest second and to see the good of the whole. Second, they feared the danger to republics from inequality, that this would erode the sort of democratic, the morale of the society, and erode republican institutions. And they pointed to the past where great inequalities of wealth had been a harbinger of the collapse of republics. And, of course, both these things, self-interest and inequality, are market-driven. They are consequences of the market. And this was something that right from the start the founders saw as threatening to our republican institutions. And I would argue that one of the things that's happened in recent years is that those fears are being borne out daily. that the market principle is now applied to politics, that the self-corrective mechanisms of democracy, here we have a problem, let's deal with it, are undermined by the influence of money on politics. For example, we can't do anything about the 45 million Americans who don't have health insurance because the lobbies, the people who pay for our politics, the corporations who do, don't want us to do that. That's an example of how democracy and the Republican institutions of actually dealing with our problems are undermined by the market.
You know, but one also must wonder from the history point, from the point of view of history, whether the founding fathers might have been most concerned about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness on paper, but they were among the most successful Americans of the time. And one wonders if they were thinking that a successful America would be a prosperous America, more acreage, more food for everyone, Americans successful in the marketplace of the time, even though the market might have been a farmer's market in Philadelphia or on Boston Common.
They had a very primitive idea of it, to be sure, and many of them were aristocrats in one way or another, and so the problems of getting and spending didn't present themselves as urgent ones.
We're talking this hour about the high cost of the market on your life. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the rough side of the American dream. You can join the conversation. Do you agree with Paul Stiles that the market is ruling our lives? What's the alternative? Do France or Germany have the answer? Is everything from corporate corruption to America's political division problems of the market? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us from the Canary Islands, Spain, is Paul Stiles, author of Riding the Bull, My Year in the Madness at Merrill Lynch. His new book is the American Dream Killing You? How the Market Rules Our Lives. His website is paulstiles.org. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. And joining us now from Honolulu, Hawaii, is Samuel Hayes, professor emeritus of investment banking at Harvard Business School, where he's taught since 1971. Professor, hello, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So tell me, do you buy this theory that the market is evil, that its excesses are evil?
Well, I think you can always find evidences of a market that has worked to the disadvantage of individuals or even for a large group. But I agree with lots of what Paul says in his book about the shortcomings of our society with stress levels and levels of unhappiness and dysfunction. I just think I disagree as to what the root cause is. I don't, first of all, believe that there is something as purposeful and as conniving as the market. I think that every time you exchange any good or service, a market is involved, and there are myriad markets that operate in our lives, and they're not coordinated, and some of them are more efficient than other markets. I think that, frankly, that Churchill said about democracy, it's awfully messy, but it's better than all the others. I think that having a market system to allocate resources is the better way to go than, for instance, using the centralized economy, such as the old communist system involved. And I think that just to give a couple of examples of why I think that a market-oriented economy and a market-oriented society makes sense is that, first of all, it gives us choice, which is something which we in the United States value very highly. Also, it channels resources more efficiently than when you have a centralized allocator of those resources. And it has certainly raised living standards in this country and in other countries that have used the market system over many generations. Market competition has created in this country the best, the most diverse higher education sector in the world. And contrast that, for instance, with the U.S.'s primary and secondary educational network, which has no competition. And
so,
think about
The market is something that should be celebrated.
It should, and it's not something which one allows to run rampant over the society. And one there have to be interventions. I think Paul makes a good point in suggesting that interventions in that market need to come at critical points.
You're successful. Worked hard to get what you've gotten, Professor. Living the American dream, or at least at this moment, I mean, you're sitting in Hawaii. Do you credit the market?
I credit the opportunity that I had in this society to go from nothing to something where I have had a very interesting career as an academic and was able to save enough money that I can spend 2 weeks in Hawaii.
No one doubts that the market is an essential part of our society, but I think it's interesting that Sam just chose higher education because there's an extraordinary percentage of people now, I think it's over a third, who are choosing economics as their major in a liberal arts college. And I think that's a fine example of how this force is overpowering our lives. And as Harold Bloom has pointed out, the humanities, at least in his opinion, but backed up by a lot of evidence, have been in decline for 30 years now. And we're seeing a record number a record decline in the amount of people who are reading. So some of the very basic aspects of the intellect are now under attack. And I think the fundamental source of that is the unbridled free market.
Paul Stein.
Well, I just want to point out that
Go ahead, Professor.
I think to intervene and to limit the number of people who can freely choose economics as a major is really going quite a long distance.
Well, I wouldn't suggest that. I mean, it raises, though, some very difficult issues. And what I'm trying to do in the book is try to rethink what all the pieces of our society really are and how they work together so that we can start to address some of this. Because you're right. How do you fix this? And a lot of people default to the idea that we should have the government get involved, or at least that someone like myself is making that recommendation. It's not the case, actually. I think that most of this rests with the individual, and I think it rests with a lot of institutions that have come under attack by the market. I think the family was the reservoir of a lot of these values. I think the educational system, I think religion has. And as I've shown in the book, virtually all of these have been corrupted to some extent by this force in our lives.
Paul Stiles, Professor Hayes, and Jack Beatty, hang on. Let's find out how the pieces of the market or the pieces of society are impacting On Point listeners today. Listeners, are you living a go-go life and why? Is the criticism of the market too harsh? 1-800-423-8255. Sebastian is calling from Boston. Hi, Sebastian.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
Well, I believe that in this country we have a lack of vacation, which is really driving us to not have any time to understand the rest of the people of the world and to go travel to these places. And I think that it's making our country very insulated and eventually is going to be our downfall.
Professor Hayes, your take on that.
Well, of course, I'm on vacation right at the moment. And I'm delighted to have this vacation, but frankly, I think that the notion that that we could somehow dictate more vacation time is really a market force in itself. In Germany, for instance, it has been mandated that each individual will have at least 6 weeks vacation. And that has been sustained over a considerable period of time, but is now coming under threat because the global market economy won't allow the pricing of the goods and services from Germany to provide for that kind of extended vacation. So we have to bear in mind that mandating vacations can only be done by taking some resources and allocating it to that purpose. And the question is, how do you want to do that?
Jack Beatty, how would we do that?
Well, you know, one way would be to, through more countervailing power. That's a phrase that John Kenneth Galbraith introduced over 50 years ago, meaning forces both within the voluntary sector and within the government that check the market, that say, wait a minute, our society is imbalanced in the market direction. There's no one speaking up for the environment. There's no one speaking up for housing for the poor. The market isn't going to do anything about medical insurance. These are market failures. More than that, they are eroding values that are important for the society as a whole through countervailing power, regulation, a strong union movement, cooperatives, that sort of thing. We need to check, countervail the power of the market to restore more social balance.
Paul Stiles?
Yeah, I'm actually somewhat of a skeptic of the government being able to do this. Because I think that something like vacation is really in the culture. That is to say, it either is or it isn't. And for instance, I'm here in Spain, and you know, I see people around me all the time who are taking 3-4 weeks vacation at a time and not really feeling guilty about it. And that's just because they come from that culture. But we've always had this market-driven culture. We've never had any countervailing cultural force that has been telling us that there are sort of higher values in life and in our society and different ways of living that make us happy that have nothing to do with productivity. So I think what we have to do is really raise consciousness on this issue. I'm really confident that if people understand the sort of mechanics of all of this, they understand, in other words, if they understand what the market is and how it relates to the rest of our society, and how if you intensify it, all these things start to break down, including your own life, and they look at the statistics, then they'll start to take the actions in their own life, which collectively will change the way we are as Americans. I just don't think the government stepping in and mandating this will do it. I think that the government could perhaps play a role in getting that word out. But fundamentally, I think it has to come from, dare I say it, books.
Back to the point of view, you mean we have to spend time reading now? Back to the point.
I have a great one for you, by the way.
back to the point of view of On Point listeners. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Michelle is phoning us from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. For Mr. Stiles, what a great book. I've been waiting for this for a long time.
Thanks.
You so much. I'm looking forward to purchasing it, buying it, and giving it to other people. The point I had to make was that one concern you raised is using a model from nature of competition and applying it to human activity. Actually, there's a lot of research in the last century that lots of examples of cooperation exist in the world of nature. And if the only model available is the survival of the fittest and the primacy of competition, it's not accurate. It's just not accurate in the biological world and in the natural world. There's just other stuff out there, a lot of good research, time to bring up, make economics reflect reality. And second of all, you know, to Professor Hayes, I'm just really struck by how he keeps raising this straw man as though the other points of view are articulating that the only way for this to happen is with some kind of, you know, heavy-handed governmental intervention. And what strikes me is that neither Mr. Stiles nor Mr. Beatty are saying that, but Professor Hayes keeps making that point over and over again. Haven't you got something else to say?
Professor Hayes.
Well, I hope so. I certainly don't mean to be too black and white on the market versus a centralized allocation system. And I, by the way, do agree with Paul and with Jack that, well, I guess more with Paul, because he says there has to be some countervailing force to an unbridled market, and I agree with him. And I think that there are instances where the government has to intervene and has to impose some limits. I think one of the best examples is the imposition of more efficient gasoline mileage on cars. This would never have been done unless the government had mandated it. And I think that you can find lots of other examples of that as well. So I don't mean to be cast as someone who thinks an unbridled market without intervention is, quote, the good thing.
But now, of course, it'll be up to the market to decide whether those hybrid cars out there will be a financial success for the automakers.
Well, that's very true. And of course, this is what you get when you have choice.
But the point that Michelle's making, I think, is that we need to put aside this what is really a Cold War mentality, which is that, you know, if you start criticizing the market, you're either a socialist or a communist. It's simply not true. You know, there are all kinds of ways that we can moderate this force, and that is actually what we need to do so that we can harness it for a higher good. And so if we can start identifying what those elements of our society are that actually do harness the market, and then we can start figuring out how we can put those in place. But the problem is that the debate kind of stops when you get into this sort of discussion where all of a sudden you have to prove that you're not a communist.
Let's take another phone call before we go to the break. Priscilla is dialing from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Priscilla.
Yes, I would like to address one piece or element that the speaker or speakers have mentioned, and that is the whole concept of spirituality, and I don't mean organized religion by a long shot, but a kind of reclaiming of the silken threads of who we are and who we are in relation to creation, to our neighbors, to the larger world. My take on this is that this constant drivenness by the market with a capital M, sort of mythical beast, if in fact it is what it is really a byproduct of a kind of spiritual malaise or dehydration. And what do I mean by that? When a person goes into overdrive towards upward mobility, whether it's the multimedia millionaires or just the person down the street who needs another a new sub, it's often because one is A, on a disconnect with the world beyond his or her orbit, and also it's a fear of death. It's a very death-denying culture, even if we see death en masse in every given newscast. But at the same time, the denial of death is actually, I think, a driving force. Whether people are cognizant of it or not, it's a very unpopular topic. But
Jack, hang on, Priscilla. Jack Beatty, is our fear of death driving this? Or are we a spiritually dried-up society?
A very interesting hypothesis. Harvey Cox, the theologian, wrote a piece for my employer, the Atlantic Monthly, a few years ago, called The Market as God, that in a sense people have idolized the market, and it's spoken of almost as a kind of substitute for the deity. Now, I think that there are countervailing forces against that from religion, and I do think that eventually the sort of re-spiritualization that we see in the country, eventually that's going to have some effect on the market, and it already is with people complaining about pornography and that sort of thing. So I think that, that maybe there's more hope for us on the spiritual side than our caller.
Jack Beatty, Paul Stiles, Sam Hayes, hang on. We're talking about the cost of the market on your life. Join the conversation. Is America at base, a society based on the market or not? Can we get away from it? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about whether the markets have taken control of your life. Join the conversation. Are you living the American dream, or are you sacrificing family, sleep, health just to stay in the game? Do you wish you were living another life? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us from the Canary Islands, Spain, is Paul Stiles, author of Riding the Bull, My Year in the Madness at Merrill Lynch. His new book is the American Dream Killing You? How the Market Rules Our Lives. Also from Honolulu, Hawaii, Sam Hayes, Professor Emeritus of Investment Banking at the Harvard Business School. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News Analyst Jack Beatty, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Just before the break, a caller raised a question about the link between the market and religion. And Paul Stiles, I'm wondering, in the book, you question whether living by the market has supplanted God, because the moral code, truth, justice, compassion, love, selflessness, is antithetical to the market code. Explain.
Yes, that's right. And I'm so glad that caller just made this point. I think what's happened is we have these two sides to life, and one is being and the other is doing. It's the best way I know of to express this spiritual point. Because doing is about productivity, and doing is ruled by the market. Being, however, is not ruled by the market. And that is the interior side of life, and has always been, the summit of that has always been God. So we have right now a real opposition that has broken out between God and the market. And you see that in the most horrific examples, in the international conflict we're in right now, or even our own domestic culture war. I think that what we need to do is understand the market for this very reason, because as this material force accelerates in our life, the ultimate expression of me versus you really is violence. And we have not typically thought of the market as a force that extends outward from business and starts touching things as far away as the family or crime and things of this nature. But truly it is when you start connecting the dots. It is a force that impacts the human spirit, and unless we have that framework of understanding that we are spiritual creatures rooted in being and not doing, in other words, if we collapse being to doing, we become human doings and not human beings, then that is contrary to all nature. And so therefore, the market must be ruled by this higher force, this higher being, and in fact, that has always been the definition, at least in the Judeo-Christian tradition.
But can't God and the market peacefully coexist? Why can't they have an equal place in our lives?
Well, the problem is that the market has become so strong that it's broken out of that that higher framework, and that's when you get pure materialism. And materialism is a philosophy based on the idea that the soul does not even exist, and we have sort of reduced that to the idea of someone leaving a mall with full shopping bags. That's not it. There is a very deadly sort of metaphysical conflict here between the spiritual and moral and material sides of life that is expressing itself everywhere. And one of the most difficult things is that it's so difficult to talk about it. I experience this all the time. You're routinely getting shut down when you bring this up in American life now. And yet it is the core issue, so I'm really glad you have brought it up.
Sam Hayes, do you have a take on this?
I certainly do. I think that the notion, first of all, that there is the market, this monolithic, aggressive beast that competes with spirituality and God, is so simplistic and so demeaning to a more in-depth exploration of the motivations that people have in our society, that I find it not functional at all to talk about it that way. I think that there's nothing that is mutually exclusive between a markets-driven economy and spirituality. And I think that some of the most productive people in the economic sense are also some of the most spiritual.
Let's bring other Let's bring other voices into the conversation. Is this just our imaginations, or do you feel the pressure, and are you immune to it? On Point listeners, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Bailey is calling from Destin, Florida. Hi, Bailey.
Hi.
Go ahead, Bailey.
Oh, sorry. This conversation is really interesting. I'm very young to feel squished by the market.
How old are you?
I'm 23.
Is the American dream killing you? Do you feel the spiritual conflict?
Well, it's actually more of a generational thing. My parents both were kind of defeated by the market right now. They work 9-to-5 jobs and don't have much to show for it, except a comfortable living, but no. You know, they didn't really pursue jobs they wanted. Like, my mother was never a journalist. My father never got to be a rock star or whatever. And my fiancé and I are both actors. Our parents, you know, really encouraged us to pursue something we loved. And so we're trying to do that, but unless you're in Hollywood, it really doesn't pay very much at all. And so we both have full-time jobs as well. And 8 hours of work plus 6 hours of rehearsal makes 14-hour days every day, and I just think it's hard to choose between the American dream of being able to support yourself and your family well, or the American dream of doing what it is you want to do and trying to accomplish that as well.
But do you place blame for this, or how do you attribute how you've made your life's decisions to this very early point in your life?
Well, I think, I don't know. I'm just very optimistic, you know, because everyone's like, you know, you can do whatever you want to do. This is America, and if you work hard enough, you can have whatever you want. So I said, okay, and, you know, trying my hand at it now, but it's just very hard to live comfortably. We don't have things like insurance or, you know, a house or anything right now, and I'm not sure at the rate we're going how long it's going to take before we can have that kind of security.
So why don't you give up what you're doing, and let me play devil's advocate, give up what you're doing and play the game and get into the marketplace so you make more money, you get your insurance, and you get your house?
I have a degree in theater. I don't have a degree in anything else.
Bailey, good luck, and thanks a lot for calling On Point.
Thank you very much.
Let's take another call. Kim is phoning us from Indianapolis, Indiana. Hi, Kim.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Great, thanks. And you?
Well, doing good. I'm listening to the On Point here, and we're talking about the market. And so the picture that I'm painting while I'm driving is that you have Dr. Hayes, I believe, from Honolulu on vacation.
That's right.
Right. Okay. So he's on vacation, and the true vacation is when you don't do any interviews. He says he's on vacation, but he's doing an interview. So basically, he is still in the market on vacation. And it's not to pick on you, Dr. Hayes, at all, but, you know, when you're in business, you try and align your life with tax breaks, and that is when you're on vacation, say, for instance, Hawaii, you may do some interviews or you may do some speaking engagements and things like that. But an actual true vacation is like that old, I think it's a Tecate commercial where, you know, you have the two chairs and the scene is you're looking out at the beach and the water and you got the two people on vacation and then you hear the beeper go off that's sitting on a little table there. And he takes the beeper and he throws it out in the water. So I just wanted to kind of paint that picture for everybody. I know someone else probably picked up on it also, that when you're on vacation, you're on vacation, you're not in the market.
How about that, Professor? Are you marketing yourself right now?
Well, I don't think of it that way. I think of it as something of a public service to get up at 4:30 in the morning, as I did this morning, in order to take this phone call. But I don't think that anything's 100%. I've had a wonderful time here. We're about to leave and go back to the real world, back to Boston. But we've had a great time, and I don't mind giving a couple of hours to to an interesting discussion like this.
Let's take another call. Laura is dialing us from Marshalltown, Iowa. Hi, Laura. What's your situation?
Hi. As a primary care provider in a community health care clinic, I have cared for many clients, especially the low-income or disenfranchised that have stress-related illnesses. And as a health care provider like myself working in this environment who puts in long hours, comes in on days off, et cetera, to satisfy administrative demands, I have experienced burnout, and I am actually changing roles in health care, and I'll have much less of an income, but hopefully less stress and improved physical and mental health. And I will have a very difficult time with my own greed and material wants, but I just want to have more of a spiritual, peaceful life. I think the definition of market often can be considered greed. I've heard market design, that type of thing talked about, or market engineering, and I just feel that rather than looking at allocating our resources as possibly communist-type thinking, maybe more humanistic-type thinking, sharing opportunities and our wealth and encouraging and educating others so that they can bring themselves up too. And I think education in our United States should be completely free. And yes, I do think we just need to look at our priorities, each and every one of us, especially with where the family situation is now in this country. Our children are our future.
Laura, thank you very much for those thoughts, and we give you for pushing us ahead into possible changes we can make if we don't like our particular place in whatever market we think we're sitting in right now. Jack Beatty, last word.
Well, Laura raises the issue of care, and there's not much premium on that. And yet that makes us more human and knits together the raw edges that the market creates. And, you know, anything that could raise the market value of the caring professions, teaching, nursing especially, would really, I think, make a lot of difference in the quality of all of our lives. And that you can do, you know, through legislation.
Sam Hayes, quick last word.
Well, I think that the caller was right in saying that she has the power to decide to reallocate her own energies and resources into a different mix. And, of course, she will have to pay the price of whatever choice she makes in terms of her
and
her job and choice.
And Paul Stiles, you've got about 10 seconds.
Well, just say the market's a very Jekyll and Hyde creature. If we have, if we surround it with the right values, it's a brilliant physician. But if we don't, then it becomes a social predator.
And market says, "I've got to go." I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. Thanks, everyone. In a moment, the jump in the use of sleeping pills among children. This is On Point.
Read the script. Go to the script.
Increasingly, children are topping off their bedtime routines of a warm bath and a tall glass of milk with sleeping pills. Use of prescription drugs by children ages 10 from 9 to ages 10 to 19 jumped 85% from 2000 to 2004, according to a new study by Medco Health Solutions, which manages drug costs for companies. This isn't a large part of the population. It represents an estimated 181,000 children, or about 0.22% of children ages 10 to 19. Explanations for the big jump include broader use of prescription drugs by children and aggressive marketing campaigns by sleeping pill manufacturers. Robert Epstein, chief medical officer for Medco, said children tend to have different sleep problems than adults.
One interesting fact that has emerged in the medical literature is that children seem to be bothered with a harder time getting to sleep at night, whereas adults have a harder time staying asleep at night. And that may be related to, you know, the cause of the sleep disorder in children. It may really be that they're just wound up and they can't get to bed at night, but once they get to sleep, they can just stay asleep. Whereas adults, insomnia may have a larger problem associated with it that's not so simple as just overstimulation or caffeinated beverages.
Go to sleep, you little babe. Go to sleep, you little babe. Go to sleep, you little babe.
Go to sleep, you little
babe. Everybody's gone in the cotton and the corn. Didn't leave nobody but the babe.
There's no easy explanation as to why more children are taking sleeping medications. It may be a function of children not being unplugged close to bedtime, using computers and computer games, etc. May relate to the use of caffeinated beverages, may even be related to the use of other medications like asthma medications or medications for attention deficit disorder. So there are a lot of things that can contribute to insomnia in children. Every year we look for trend accelerators and decelerators, drug use that goes up or down, and we found that the sleep category in children really outpaced almost all the other categories. The behavioral medications in general were real accelerators for children, and there were some decelerators, things like antibiotics, which actually showed a negative trend for the first time in 2004. Some of the downsides of this type of medication use in children include having a kind of a hangover in the morning, not dealing with the problem that's causing the sleep disorder to begin with, and also subjecting the child needlessly to very strong medication when there could be other strategies to help their sleep problem. Well, certainly we're seeing from other studies that were funded by the federal government that upwards of 17% of children do suffer from chronic insomnia. So the fact that we're seeing, you know, a couple percent of children taking prescription drugs is not a complete surprise. On the other hand, you want to be sure that other strategies for helping the insomnia have first been exhausted before leaping to a prescription drug. We see over the next few years a number of new products coming to market. This year alone, there were two new sleeping medications that were brought to market. We see one more coming next year, and then one of the branded drugs today, Ambien, potentially going generic in the next year, year and a half. So there's going to be a lot of activity in this area, and it wouldn't surprise us to see an increasing use of these kinds of drugs. There has been some evolving research looking at different forms of drugs to help the different types of sleep pattern problems. So you may see the day when a person who has trouble getting to sleep takes one kind of medication, whereas a person who has trouble staying asleep would take a different kind of a medication. And I think we're going to see that kind of personalized medicine in the years to come.
Now it's time to say goodnight, goodnight, sleep tight.
Robert Epstein is Chief Medical Officer for Medco Health Solutions. He spoke with us from Franklin Lakes, New Jersey. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.